Okay, I'm going to get started. I thank Michael and Takeshi for, and Sri for including me in this great workshop. I'm going to be talking about strongly anharmonic solids, vibrational modes, and jam systems. So what I mean by a jam system is you can think of it as a packing of hard spheres. So even though Takeshi yesterday was pointing out maybe some what was the phrase he used? Singularities or some special features of the hard sphere model. That's exclusive. Notice why that fell out of my mind. Pathologies, anomalies of the hard sphere model. This is what I'm going to be talking about today. The first day I got here, I briefly introduced the talk, and Takeshi immediately said, "Oh, well, that, you know, a lot of that's going on in the potentials or the bulk metallic glasses that he's studying. So hopefully you'll be able to find the features or relate the two systems together." What's that thing down there? That's my cup. So another interesting feature is I found out today my office mate and I are basically brothers. We both graduated from Penn. I graduated before he did. We both have a PhD in physics from University of Pennsylvania with advisor Tom Lubensky. So that's very nice that you put, you know, brothers in offices. I didn't know that's how it worked. Yeah, so I graduated from Penn in 1999. Then I went to Chicago and Los Angeles to work with Sid Nagel and Andrea Liu for a postdoc. And I've been at Yale in the School of Engineering and Applied Science and Physics since 2002. The featured questions today are a topic that I got very interested in coming from this this community of studying packings with Sid and Andrea. But for some reason, we haven't thought about packings in this way. So I think this is very novel. None of this is published. It's basically a week old. So I hope that you'll join in and attack me on this, or friendly attack. The questions that I'm going to be talking about are, what can we learn about vibrations and amorphous solids from static configurations? So that's been the mantra, that's been the tactic that people have used so far, that you take a look at a static configuration and you can understand the small amplitude vibrations of the system. So I'm going to do the obvious thing. I'm not going to look at static configurations and try to understand vibrations. I'm actually going to vibrate the thing and see what it does. If it's a harmonic system, those two things will be the same. And so the answer to those questions are you can learn everything or you can learn nothing. The literature so far has basically said everything, and I'm going to lean on the side of saying nothing, and the answer will be somewhere in the middle. So a jam solid is something very specific. It's going to be these contact interactions, a solid that where enough particles are in contact so that you can't displace either individual particles or groups of particles without causing overlap. And so I'm going to talk very specifically about what I mean by a jam solid. And if they're not harmonic, how anharmonic are they? Are they just a little anharmonic, so it doesn't really matter? Or are they really completely different objects? So this has relevance to dispersion, nonlinear response, and heat transport in particulate media. In particular, there's been very recent effort on trying to understand heat transport in colloids and granular media just using the Hessian of the static configuration. So one natural question is that correct to do? So here, just to start whetting your appetite, I'm just going to, Dan, is that right? As Dan pointed out, I don't have view graphs, so I can show you a movie of what I mean. So here's a static configuration. It has 22 contacts, I think 6 particles, and it's mechanically stable. In a static situation. And now I'm just going to add vibrations to the system, and you'll see that contacts are going to break and form. And so we're going to ask, what does that mean? So you see particles are breaking and reforming. There's going to be some very interesting fluctuation there. And the interesting feature is that it's going to have a duality. So a lot of people study hard sphere systems. A lot of people study soft sphere systems. I imagine in this system, because contacts are remaining intact, that there is a soft interaction, but contacts are also breaking and it's acting like hard spheres. So we're going to talk about a system where you can have hard sphere behavior and soft sphere behavior. You can have overlap and elastic interactions, and you can have collision impacts.
So I'm just a little confused. So when I look at the pic on the left and you say static packing and it's jammed, okay, I look at that and that looks okay. So I'm wondering how things can vibrate. I mean, you have to have some place for one of the atoms to move to, and if it's mechanically jammed, then it can't move unless something else moves first. So
that's part of the issue. So if you treat them as exactly hard, then that is true.
So in this vibrating sense?
In this vibrating system, the way I did it is that there are some deformations that occur.
Okay.
But you'll see that sort of duality between hard and soft, and so look for that.
But you have to step away from this rigorous hard sphere or hard circle idea initially to
exactly
vibration in jammed systems.
Exactly.
But you are looking at just touching states. So if you compress the hell out of these things and they were really compressed, then you wouldn't have this issue so much.
Well, so let me just state it a slightly different way. So if I focus in on a given contact, these particles do have overlaps, even in this state. So that's exactly what I'm getting at. In hard spheres, what happens? Do they all come into contact at the same time? No. So the way I get around that is that these particles actually have small overlaps that stabilize. Are all the overlaps the same size? No. That's really what I'm interrogating here. What's the distribution of overlaps, or what's, in a hard sphere sense, what's the distribution of distances from contacts?
So when you talk about duality between hard and soft, I mean, you have to step away from hard to even move forward at all. But it still retains some character, some hard contact features.
Exactly. If I were going to do a hard sphere simulation on this, even though you can't see it, I would have to back away a little bit because these are actually overlapped, and then do literally a hard sphere simulation where I didn't allow overlap. I'm saying to study this, that's actually a stupid thing to do because the system, if you look at sort of colloids and granular materials, actually do have some compression. So there are hard sphere and soft sphere features.
So define some Hessian and harmonic vibrations about strictly for hard
spheres.
Yeah.
So if it's for hard sphere, there actually is work that. So I'm going to answer your question. The answer is yes, actually.
That's exactly. Yeah. That's why I call the strict hard sphere pathological.
But so it's not. It's quasi pathological. So there's recent work by Mathieu Wiart where he looks at effective potentials for hard spheres.
Yes, that's some sort of a density function, not a energy function as such.
That's right. It's a time averaged potential. So this is the O'Hearn group. Mark Shattuck has been a driver for this work. Rob is here, and you're going to hear about what he's working on. I'm going to mention briefly something that he is interested in. The main drivers are Carl Schreck and I hope Gila makes fun of me. So when Thibault came, I called him Thibault Bertrand. where's he? And he politely said, my name is Thibault. I said, oh, that's a nice name. And so he's going to be a joint PhD student between ENS and Yale, working with Eric Clément. So that he's an excellent student. OK, so what I mean by a jam solid. So this is what I mean. The first is that the particulate aspect of the material is very important, that the interactions really do stop at the size of the particle. So this is a key difference between metallic glasses, for example. But it's an interesting feature. So the contact interactions, I'm going to be looking at amorphous systems, but I could look at partially ordered, frictionless. Even though these look like hard spheres, they have vanishingly small overlaps. But we can vary how much overlap there is. So if I look at a, if I tell you that this is a packing, I have to specify a few properties. I have to tell you what's the packing fraction at this state, which is the ratio of the area of the circles divided by the area of the box. These are typically somewhere between 75% and 85% packing fraction. I have to tell you what the contact number is at this state, how many contacts each part, how many total contacts the system has, or how many contacts each particle has. And the potential energy, or the pressure, is small, because I'm thinking about this these soft models where the energy and the potential, the pressure go to zero with overlap. So these systems are in force balance with these various overlaps, and they're mechanically stable. So if I push on a particle a little bit, we need to discuss that a little bit more. And if you think of them as truly hard, there's no way of moving an individual particle or a group of particles so that you don't cause particle overlap.
So you don't allow for a particle being in a cage where it can rattle around.
Yeah, and so I'm not showing that here, but that's actually a great point and a great cause of consternation, and has been, I'll show you a particular fight in the literature. So these particles I'm going to call rattlers, and they actually are very important, because if I undergo a vibration, it's possible that a particle could touch that particle. And so yes, I am going to include those. It's not shown here, but I'm going to get to that.
And just to help sort of engage your thinking, we're going to be dealing with two-dimensional systems.
I refuse to answer that question.
Okay.
No, we're going to be talking about two-dimensional systems, but my claim is that's irrelevant for what I'm talking about. And you bring that up again if you think it is.
Okay. And then also, are there attractive forces between the particles, or is it just like a constant volume?
I'll get to that in 1 second. So I'll answer your question. They're purely repulsive.
Okay. Your coffee really wants to be in the show too.
The way that I create these packings, I think it's helpful to at least get you thinking about it, is that I can specify a certain interaction between the particles. Like I just mentioned, they're purely repulsive. That cuts off at the particle size. And so you can then think of a potential energy landscape. And if the particles are overcompressed, then I'll have an energy, a local minimum, where the energy is greater than zero. So the particles want to fly out because they're overcompressed. Whereas if the particles aren't overlapping, there's a degeneracy here. There are sets of configurations which all have zero energy, corresponding to moving the particles in these cages. And so the system can exist anywhere in here and have zero energy. Whereas I'm interested in where these minima are slowly crept down to zero, where I have a packing with small overlaps. But again, the whole crux of the problem is, what is the distribution of overlaps in the state? Are they all the same? And what's that distribution? Because that will affect the vibrations.
But yep. These two are not completely separate, right?
What?
If you try to achieve this central path, you may have to include this degenerate space.
In the sense that particles come out of contact.
Right.
Right, so I was thinking of this degeneracy sort of as, so there will be a percolation or a network of contacts that fills the entire system. And then you can think of these particles which don't have contact, which are loose.
Yeah.
Those are typically on the order of one particle. So it's not, here I'm just, in terms of this diagram, I'm thinking of the entire system as degenerate. So yes, there will be these degeneracies which correspond to one particle or a small subset of particles. Um, I'm going to go on an interlude for a second, which is not related directly related to this talk, but if you want to talk to me about this, I'd be more than happy to talk to you about it. The idea is that since we're talking about these packings, there was this interesting statement by Edwards, which got me thinking. It says that for a given volume, all jam configurations, and these jam configurations are the ones that I've been talking about thus far, are equally probable. And so that statement was a supposition that led to a thermodynamics assuming this. And so what I've shown recently, or not so recently anymore, is that the jam packings aren't equally likely. So these two packings are roughly the same packing fraction, but this one occurs a million times, and this one occurs once for a given protocol. And so an interesting question is, since these are occurring a million times and this is occurring once, what determines the probability with which you get a packing? This could be related to metallic glasses and inherent structures. With what probability do you get a particular glass? And
it looks like it's for a well-stirred system.
For a what?
Well-stirred system.
What does that mean?
I don't know. I won't defend what he said, but that's, yeah. So, it depends on how you prepare it.
And that's exactly what I'm saying. So,
Define a well-stirred system as one in which everything is equal configuration.
So then it's a tautology. So I just want to unwrap this tautology, okay? So basically, so let's not get on Edwards. Let's just say an interesting question would be, what determines the probability with which you get a certain glass? And that's an interesting question. That those glasses have certain mechanical and structural properties, so it'd be very interesting if you could determine that for a given system. So
were we supposed to immediately see what was different between those two? Packing fraction was different.
No.
Just the
configuration.
I like having you around. So these packing fractions are roughly the same. That's what you're supposed to get out of it. But I'm telling you, you can't see it, that this one occurs a million times in my protocol. You may say, well, you have a really really bad protocol that says this one occurs a million times and this one occurs once. Now I'm saying this is a fairly benign protocol, and you're not supposed to see the difference really in this. Because that's the paper said it's really hard to determine what sets the packing probabilities, which makes it an interesting problem.
That, I mean, that's what Dr. Frank is measuring.
Yeah.
With his log volumes, right? So
we've
consistent with the fact that these volumes have exponentially large variations.
That's right, and we've measured these. We measured those probabilities.
I'm confused about this. I mean, this is obviously a small portion of a large sample.
That's not so obvious. that's a question I'm very interested in. But these actually are periodic. These are periodic systems. So these are small systems. And so a question is that you want to know what the probability of getting a large sample is. Is it just the uncorrelated multiply the uncorrelated probabilities of these subsystems? So that's one thing we're working on.
So the energies are pretty much the same.
So the energies are exactly the same. Because these are
just packing.
These are packing. Yeah.
Number of contacts are the same.
Yes.
I'm sorry. Was that a yes?
Yes.
And the packing fraction is almost the same. You said
it's the same.
It is the same.
Okay. So getting back to what Peter said, I hope Don has cited me and
oh,
this
yeah.
one. So the question is, can we predict the probability to obtain these packings? And so one thing is that if you have an infinite quench, you can just say that the probability that you get a particular jam packing is the volume of the basin of that jam packing divided by and normalized by all of the basin volumes. And so what's interesting in that Ashwin is working on is that we have a system where you can actually calculate these exactly. I think Don is working on I haven't seen his talk, but working on a similar thing. And since we can calculate all the basin volumes, you can find out, I have it here, you can find out what the infinite quench rate limit is. So in the infinite, if you do this really fast, you'll just explore basin volumes. So the probability with which you get a certain state is proportional to the basin volume. And what Peter was saying was that these basin volumes have exponentially different volumes. And so you can get very large differences in probabilities. What's nice if you can calculate all the structures is that you can calculate these critical quench rates. So above a certain rate, you'll do the equally probable sampling like Edwards was suggesting.
Above a certain quench rate.
In the sense that so Edwards was wrong. You'll be sampling them according to the basin volume. So above a certain quench rate, you'll be sampling them according to the basin volume. So you can, this critical quench rate value is an important number. It basically says something about what's the first barrier or something like that. How easy is it to get out of the first, the basin you're in? And so you can do the same thing in terms of going very much slower. So here we have the infinite quench rate value probability on the vertical axis versus state for some model. It's not important right now. And at high rates, you recover the infinite quench rate answer. Basin probability is proportional to basin volume. And then as you lower the quench rate, you go towards the crystal. And so there'll also be a critical quench rate corresponding to how slow you can go. If you go slow enough, you'll get into the crystal state. So these two critical quench rate that I'm saying are very important. So that's the interlude. That's related to Ashwin and Rob's work. Rob's going to be working with single chain polymers and asking a very similar question. So now I'm going on to the point of the talk. Forgive me for this cartoon for metals or harmonic solids. What I'm drawing here is a Leonard Jones potential explicitly, but the only thing that I'm pointing out is that it has a well-defined minimum here between particles. And it's continuous, that it doesn't cut off at some short range. So if the particles go up here, they know to come back. Anharmonicities can come into this potential if sort of the particles feel these shoulders, as Geshe was saying. But it's been shown and likely that for low enough temperatures, the particles will sit, each sort of contact will sit close enough to this minimum that you'll have a good harmonic approximation. This is the contrast. So these are the potentials that I'm considering today. They're contact interactions. So here's the math, and here's a plot of that for a particular type of power law, a spring interaction. So this would be a linear repulsive spring. So if you're compressed, if your separations are smaller than the sum of the diameters of the particles, then you feel this force law. If your separation is greater than the sum of your radii, then you don't have any interaction. And so that corresponds to this.
I'm sorry, maybe it's just an unfortunate choice of words, but you said a spring-like interaction, but I think a spring is being linear, and you're showing this is nonlinear. So
yeah, it's just because I'm plotting potential energy instead of the force.
Well, it's not just that, but you also, as the separation becomes smaller, the contact area becomes larger.
Isn't that little curved line bent the wrong way?
No.
It's not a linear. The force doesn't increase linear with decreasing separation. It increases faster than that. Is that right?
No. So you can just write this as delta, as the overlap or the overlap. So this is the potential goes as delta squared. So it's quadratic in the overlap. The force would be linear in the overlap.
Yeah, but you're talking about the energy. The energy, yeah.
So the energy increases quadratically with the force is linear.
They're not more than the solid particles here. Yeah. 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 Sort of 3D extent. They're point particles with springs between them.
Yeah, that's a good way of saying it. Right. They're point particles with springs between them. The key point is that one of the key points is that I don't have something coming up to suck me back. That if I'm pushed out of the interaction, I'm pushed out of the interaction, which makes these rattler particles very important. So this is what people have done, including me. We take a static configuration. I've shown these static configurations, and I calculate the dynamical matrix. So I've I've supposed a certain interaction potential between all pairs. I can sum that interaction potential up over all pairs of interacting particles. And then I can imagine taking these virtual derivatives. If I move particle alpha by some amount, and I move particle beta by some amount, how does this energy change? And then I evaluate it at the equilibrium position. So the key point about this is these are virtual displacements in the sense that I'm not keeping track of whether contacts break and form. I'm doing this derivative essentially analytically. I have some simple interaction potential between grains, and I just take these derivatives analytically, and then I evaluate it at this equilibrium position. That's not what the system would do. The system would undergo vibrations and be allowed to break and form contacts.
The fact that your curvature is discontinuous at the contact position, you know the problem?
So I'm going to talk about that in 1 second. And But again, let me emphasize the point. Just on the face of it, since I'm not talking about when contacts can break and form, I'm not justified in making this approximation. So with that, that I'm not justified in making that approximation, I'm going to make that approximation. And I'm going to show the spectrum of those modes. This is taken from a really nice recent paper. I don't think it's even out. It's a review. Lou Nagel, maybe some of you are participating in this volume. This is the introduction to a volume on jamming, and that's going to appear in Soft Matter in 2010. And these two figures are taken from that. So the density of states, the density of these vibrational modes is basically sort of the number of modes between omega and omega plus d of omega subtracted from the number of modes at omega. And I'm plotting it for the same system, the density of states versus frequency. So what I do is I take this matrix and then I diagonalize it, and that gives me a spectrum of normal modes that are labeled by omega, and then I have those eigenvalues and eigenvectors. So there's an eigenvector associated with each omega, which tells me how do I actually move these particles, what's the displacement that I do to get this energy, which is proportional to omega squared. And so I'm plotting a 3D system now, monodispersed particles, and I'm plotting it as a function of, here these are on linear scales, this is on a log scale, and I'm plotting it for different amounts of compression. Whenever you see phi minus phi c or phi minus phi j, that means there's some point of jamming where the overlaps just go away, and then you compress above that by a certain amount, and that amount is called phi minus phi c, delta phi minus phi j, take your pick. And so here you see fairly large amounts from 1% up to 60%, and here you see very minuscule amounts. And the key points of the spectrum that were noticed were that although if the system's highly compressed, you recover Debye-like behavior that goes as omega squared, so the density of vibrational modes at low frequencies goes to zero at fairly large compressions, that you start to have this plateau that forms where you have an excess of vibrational modes above what you would expect from an ordered system. And so what people have done is they've characterized omega star, which is the crossover from the flat plateau to Debye behavior, and characterized that as a function of delta phi. And this omega star has been linked to a growing length scale in the system. And so what I'm suggesting is how, or what I'm asking is how is this behavior, how does this change if you think about breaking and forming contacts? Is it just a sort of a fluctuation on top of this behavior, or does it fundamentally change? So what are some causes of anharmonicity?
This is what that's done by diagonalization, not by real NP, right?
Exactly. So I'm going to, this is diagonalization, and I'm going to do real NP.
When you take the derivatives, displacement gets smaller and smaller as phi minus phi c gets smaller and smaller.
These are formal derivatives. Does that answer?
I mean, they have an analytic potential.
I mean, so typically what's been done in the past is you have a fairly simple expression for the interaction potential between particles, and then you just formally take derivatives of those potentials, ignoring the discontinuity in the second derivative.
Are you going to tell us about the nature of these modes? I mean, they're localized or extended or something like that?
I'm not going to today, but I'd love to schedule another. The problem why I'm not going to is because sort of the framing of this talk is, well, maybe those aren't even the modes. I mean, it's possible that those are...
Because they're strongly anharmonic.
So there's a lot of interesting features in swirling behavior in those modes and whether they're quasi-localized or... The crux of the talk is, I'm not saying they're not, this is not going to turn out to be true. I'm saying, what if? Okay, so causes of anharmonicity are nonlinear interaction potential. So the interaction potential can be Hertzian. That power law that Dan was talking about could be anything. So you can get anharmonicity that way. People know that if you have a network of springs, if they're stressed springs, you can get anharmonicity. I'll talk about that briefly. And then the pink elephant in the room is the breaking and forming of contacts. That can give you anharmonicity. And then something else I'm interested in, which is not as relevant, is that you can have explicit dissipation from normal contacts, and you can have friction. One interesting question would be, what's sort of the amount of anharmonicity in these effects, and how does that compare with the amount of anharmonicity in the above the dashed line?
And at this point, you don't have any I don't even know how to say it. So you've got friction stuff, but you don't have.
So I don't have any
energy from bond bending.
That's right. The only thing I have from bond, well, anything I have from bond bending comes from the central potential. So then the force actually becomes less. I don't have any of this. I really just have springs. So if you do if you ignore the discontinuities in the second derivative, you already have anharmonicities coming in from the stress spring network. So even if this is a harmonic potential, one-sided harmonic potential, you already have anharmonicities coming in. So one question that we have to ask is how do these anharmonicities coming in from the stretched spring networks, how do they compare to breaking and forming contacts? Another thing that some of you have already alluded to I'm getting to here. So what happens during overlap and underlap with these types of potentials? So if you have underlap, what happens is you have some region in...
Is that a word?
New word.
That reminds me of underdog.
I just assume, you're going to see underlap a lot. So is it a word?
I don't know. You made it a word, so it's not.
We know what you mean.
So this is underlap. And so the way that my potentials work is that if the particles aren't overlapping, they're underlapping. And you'll have, if you interact with this sphere, if you overlap with this sphere, you'll feel energy, and you'll feel energy here. But in the middle, there's the energy is zero. And so if I take the derivative of this, you get something that looks like this. And so my comment about the discontinuity is that you can consider potentials where you smooth this out, but that won't that doesn't affect my results. The point is that when you go from contact to no contact, you're going to feel an anharmonicity. My specific ones that I'm studying here have this discontinuity.
I think that's quite a strong contention that really making that continuous wouldn't change anything.
So would not change anything. Did I say that? Did I say underlap? No. What I'm saying, let me say it a little better. Yeah, keep me honest. That's good. What I can imagine doing is smoothing this out. And what I'm saying is a key feature is that I have to actually do that. You know, I have to go from here to here. And so yes, there'll be effects, but what I want to study is that I have to go from here to here, not how I go. So
you see, the issue is that the amount of curvature in the amount of V double prime you're getting on small compression can be made small as once your alpha is bigger than two. Right. So if you have a small amount of compression and also your curvature has a small contribution,
that thing will come down.
Yeah, I mean, it won't just come down. I mean, there'll be a region where it's very small.
So let me just say it this way. I'm interested in studying.
Okay.
I'm interested in studying that.
I'll have for you to look at alpha equals two.
And then similarly, you also have discontinuities when you're overlapped because you go from different spring one spring constant to another. So you have to talk about how you go up in spring constant also. Okay, so another question is, do jammed solids have equilibrium positions? This is just to get you thinking. This is a static force balance configuration like I showed on the first slide. And the question is, when you start adding vibrations, does that just go to hell? Does that just break and you can't even talk about these equilibrium positions? So these are the types of things that I'm going to do for the rest of the talk. I'm going to do MD, essentially, and look at the vibrations. What I'm going to do is there's some undeformed positions of the particles. There's some static set of eigenvalues and eigenvectors. And I'm going to deform along that static set by some amount delta. And I'm then going to run at constant energy, including that deformation. And the system is going to, the question is, does it undergo vibrations at that frequency? If it undergoes vibrations at that frequency, then this is a good set of eigenvectors and eigenvalues. If it doesn't, it's not. And so these arrows represent delta times this eigenvector. It's kind of interesting. It's kind of like a string. Here, I showed a mode here. It's for six particles, but I showed a mode.
Yes.
So you can't fault me for that.
Why am I running at NBE?
I don't want to, I could run at NBT, but then I'm connecting it to a bath, and so
okay.
Here I just want to see if that mode stays. Eventually, if that mode leaks out, it'll be like being in a bath, but if I do it at constant energy, I have the best hope of having it oscillate at that frequency.
You want to look at the lifetime.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so now I'm going to show you lots of results.
Sorry, is it constant energy? What's the restoring point?
You mean, why doesn't it just go in that direction? Or?
Why didn't it just stay where it is?
It's like that one goes away. It moves out of the
thing. Triangle.
Yeah, so the question is, so let's say it again.
So it's not a constant.
It's, well, it'll transform between kinetic and potential.
Total
energy. Total
energy.
I'm a little confused. The whole thing about the jamming is at zero temperature and it's non-equilibrium.
No, that's not the whole. Well.
Just say
a little.
What we're discussing now is.
No, say a little more to all. Just, I want to answer your question, but just
you
say.
Can change
a,
my words.
So let me paraphrase what you're saying.
Yes, please.
The dynamical matrix is supposed to describe the vibrations of the system. It's supposed to describe low temperature properties, small deformations of the system. And the question is, does it?
No, I agree with the question, but of course.
So, people have said that, this controls the low temperature.
No, I'm not arguing about the fact that that should be checked, that it's interesting. But the whole point J thing, which is where you're just barely touching, is a zero temperature, maybe non-equilibrium state, right? So you're in fact using a dynamical matrix around a state which is well defined, but it's not clear that it.
So I'll say even that is not a good thing to, because you. It's actually the t equals zero states are not that interesting. I mean, you're interested in how the system goes from one to another. You know.
Of course, where you move away from t equals zero, I completely agree. But still, your starting point is not equilibrium. And actually, the protocol that you were using doing those stuff in the old days was a non-equilibrium protocol. Right. So. How does this connect to the fact that now you're doing MD and you're equilibrating the system? And that,
I'm not equilibrating the system. I mean, the way that this system would be equilibrated is if it could move. So you'll see in a second, these systems are going to move. You're not going to be able to see it, actually.
So you're starting from configurations that you obtain from a non-equilibrium protocol at zero temperature. So you're out of equilibrium. And now you're putting a little bit of relaxation and vibration in your system that you're studying by end. Is that the, that's, I understand correctly?
So one way I think of these
Just two more slides and then ask it again.
Okay.
So I just want to give you an idea of what the system actually does. So this is a static snapshot, and then you actually do that deformation. And this is what the system does. And this is eight orders of magnitude, or say six orders of magnitude larger than the interesting anharmonicities come in. Six orders of magnitude larger.
Say that again?
So this system will display anharmonicities. So this system that I show you that's fluctuating displays extreme anharmonicities, but the onset of anharmonicities are six orders of magnitude lower in amplitude.
In delta.
So these are extremely subtle effects. So this you can sort of already see that it's anharmonic. If you caught it, the contact network at the beginning is nothing like what the contact network is now. And so what you'd think right now is that you have to find equilibrium positions and find out what the sort of equilibrium state here is and then expand about that. But the static configuration is not relevant to this system at all. But I just want to give you the idea that anharmonicities are extremely subtle because you're talking about breaking and forming contacts. And then I just want to show you one more thing. Maybe this will help, and then Jill can ask us a question. This is just a quick phase diagram in terms of delta. Delta is the amount that I perturb. So some fraction of the particle size is what leads to a cage breaking event. So if you move a particle by a tenth of its diameter, it'll form a new cage, get a new jam state. It's sort of what we think of as a different state. That's enormous on the scale of delta. The anharmonicity due to the shape of the potential is up here at 10 to the minus 2. The onset of contacts breaking and anharmonicity is down at enormously small values of delta because I'm at this just touching state. So a very interesting question will be, how do these effects change with the amount of compression that I have?
How can you have harmonic contact breakings?
You can't.
Why is that so loud?
Say that again. So this.
In the first contact breaks, how can that be different than the onset of an anharmonicity?
It's a subtlety that I'll talk to you about in a second.
Okay.
Also depends on the stiffness.
Yeah. You mean the shape of the potential? I'm scaling energy by that. So that stiffness won't affect things. But if I change the shape of the potential, it will. So
going back to Jill, these are just inherent structures of your repulsive potential, but all the inherent structures. Not equilibrated at temperature. Like infinite temperature.
Going from very high temperature.
Exactly. And then he's just looking at what the vibrations are of those. But I think the just touching is it's crucial, right?
Well, I'm going to talk about that. I hope not. I mean, okay. I mean, maybe that's sort of what you're getting at. I'm not sure. I'm not sure what you're getting at, so maybe ask it again. Do you want to ask them in two more slides? Here, I just want to show you, I look at the mean square displacement from the static configuration. So you look at the mean square displacement averaged over time. So how far is the system moving from its initial static configuration? And you see it moves from its initial static configuration. So this is something you have to keep track of. You have some static configuration, then you add vibrations, you have to ask, how does it change? OK, so this slide, even though it's not the highest quality, you have to ask me lots of questions, because I'm going to show you like six more of these. And you're just going to get really bored if you don't understand it. So what I'm doing is, on one side, looking at the frequency spectrum, and on this side, looking at a sort of time dependence of the modes. So on the one hand, you're supposed to look at, so for the frequency dependence, you're supposed to look at this part. And for the time dependence, you look at the whole part. So for the frequency dependence, I take the displacement of the system from its equilibrium position, I dot it into the static mode, and then I take the Fourier transform. So this is a way of decomposing your displacements onto the basis that you had. And you can look at the frequencies. And the other one is to just bring it back to the time domain and look at the amplitude of each mode as a function of time. So one is the frequency space, and one is in the time domain.
What's H
to S? H is the heavy side to get rid of the negative frequencies.
All right. Maybe just a sign from the lowest energy. And
yes. Yeah, and so maybe this answers your question. So in this small system, I have a discrete set of frequencies labeled. Some are trivial because of I have periodic boundary conditions, so you have translational invariants. So these are the non-trivial modes. There's a finite set of them. And this is the frequency spectrum. So I only have these discrete set of modes, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, or whatever. And what happens if the system, you'll see in a second, if the system stays, so I'm exciting this mode. So what this shows is the frequency decomposition as a function of time. So the lowest times are at the lower ends of the breaking up of the vertical scales. And then as you go later in time, you move up to the upper bar. So, okay. So what happens here is that this is the mode that was excited, and so you see that it touches the bottom of its bar. So that means that the only mode at zero time is the frequency I excited.
That's the cyan mode, right?
That's the cyan mode.
Okay.
As you go later in time, you'll have modes that occur at the upper bar, which means that other frequencies have come in. Okay. So you see at later times, this mode has come in, this mode has come in, and this mode has come in. The lowest, in particular, lowest frequency mode has come in. So
you excited one mode, and then
it generated other modes. It coupled to other modes.
Which is
OK, now what this is, though, is this delta is very large. So this actually was done on a double-sided potential, so the contacts don't break and reform. And so this shows anharmonicity just due to the potential. So this is a check. If I look at deltas that are enormously small, it would just be a line like that. And I'll show you that in a second. So, but this is just a reference to what happens to the shape of the potential. And I'll do this for other potentials.
Since you're doing a Fourier transform, why do you put the heavy side? I mean, technically, if it's a Fourier transform, you should include, wouldn't you?
I wanted to get back the original time dependence. So Rob, we'll talk about that in a little while. Okay, so here's the real system. It's the single-sided potentials. And now I show you these plots at different deltas. So this shows you actually how the system breaks. So here, at very low delta, no contact. So this is contact. This is the amplitude of the modes, the time dependence, and this is the frequency spectrum.
That's your AM of T.
This one's AM of t, and this is that frequency plot. And this is a new plot, which is the number of contacts in the system. If you don't have any contacts that break or form, the system's going to be harmonic. So that's what it does. You excite this mode, and it stays in that mode the whole time, and nothing else leaks. Nothing else comes in. So that is a this set of modes is a valid set. But then as you start to break contacts, so the system has different numbers of contacts that form and break, and you see that these other modes start to come in, and you see it in the spectrum. What you're supposed to see here is actually, you see some fuzz there. So that means that the system is moving over to a continuous set of modes, which is interesting. So what you're supposed to see here, which you really can't see it, is the curvature is half, and it's going more towards a continuous set of modes.
I'm kind of curious, in the largest delta,
yeah.
You start from a different number of contacts. I mean, you never have more than 10, whereas in the others, you always start with, or you have 11.
So the base state was 11. And so that's like...
So you actually changed that by putting in a large delta.
Yeah, so what happens now is you put in a large delta and the configuration changed. And so now so it can lose contacts and form contacts.
Well, you say it can lose or form, but I mean, it looks like there's a net loss.
Exactly. So in this particular...
I'm just checking to make sure that...
In this particular case, yeah, it doesn't go above 11. And so this is a close-up. This is the same set of configurations, except I have a much narrower scale of delta. So I'm trying to... This is related to Rob's comment of narrowing in on where the anharmonicity comes in. And so now you see what I'm going to want to do. I'm going to want to predict the onset of anharmonicity. And if you're thinking, you'll probably just say it's in G of R. Well, it is in G of R. Well, modulo a complication. So here you see the modes start to come in. So we've narrowed it down to somewhere between 8.3 times 10 to the minus 9 delta for this particular configuration. So you can go in and really look when the anharmonicity comes in. This is how we do it.
Are you going to talk about if you look at different configurations, statistically, what happens?
I'm going to look at different modes, applying different modes, which I think is similar, but I'm going to do that, today. Okay, so I think Bulbul already mentioned this. This is, again, exciting that mode, but doing it at different deltas. And so there's time dependence. If you excite a smaller delta, it'll take longer to be anharmonic. If you excite a larger delta, it'll take less time to be anharmonic. And we just measured the tau to become anharmonic as when it dives down. So the originally, it's all sort of localized in the mode that I excited, and then it dives down and sort of gets to a steady state. And so I'm going to measure this tau as a function of delta. This is just one of the things that we can do. One interesting thing is that, so this is tau versus delta minus delta star, where delta star is just where this gives a power law. I know that power laws aren't always the way things are, and so this is just a first note. But it appears, if you look at this divergence, it appears to be happening around 8.3, right? That's where it seems to be really going up, at 8.3. Well, the first contact that breaks is at 8.1. So that's the thing I was talking about. There's a little bit of
divergence.
And so I'm going to talk about that in a second. Another interesting thing is it's possible that there's some equipartition going on. So what I'm doing now is I'm exciting all the possible modes. So I excited mode number 4. And then I saw what happened. Well, now I'm going to excite all the original modes of the static configuration. And then look at what the steady state amplitude is. What is the steady state amplitude of each mode after I excite along a particular mode? And it looks like the steady state amplitude goes as 1 over omega, which is consistent with a squared times omega squared is a constant. So it seems to know how to put these modes in the steady state. Okay. Another interesting thing, which is extremely relevant, is
isn't that weird? I mean, because that would sort of suggest that the frequencies that you calculated are relevant, even though the thing isn't harmonic.
Exactly. But the thing is you need to know. I don't know. I don't know if they're all going to shift by a factor of two. If some are going to shift more than others. Right now I'm just giving you observations.
Couldn't the anharmonicity be the deviation from an exactly straight line, though?
Yeah. Yep.
Possible.
So an interesting question is, can we predict this anharmonicity from G of R? So the interesting thing about G of R in these models is that, bless you, there's a low side and a high side. So the low side corresponds to what? It corresponds to underlap. The particles aren't in contact. Is that right? Maybe so. The other way around. Good. The low side is overlap. The high side is underlap. And so, because there's leakage in both directions, that's where perhaps the answer to this question is.
And if you had hard spheres, you wouldn't have one side.
Right. If you had hard spheres, you'd just have one side coming down. There have been two papers, there have been a number of papers that have looked at G of R, radial distribution function for jam packings. One by me, and then more recent work by Torquato and Nagel, Liu, Silver. So just to give you the notation, a relevant parameter that I was just talking about is, I call it R. It can be positive for underlap, if your separations are greater than the sum of your radii, or it can be negative for overlap if the separations are less than the sum of the radii. Which are those right there. And I'm going to talk about these parameters, which I think are relevant, R plus and R minus. R plus is the smallest R greater than 0. So what you can do is look at all the R's that are greater than 0, and you can order them from largest to smallest. I'm saying the relevant ones are the smallest ones, because those are the first ones that are going to come into contact. If R is very small, it's just about to come into contact. And same with R minus. It's the smallest R less than 0. So you have a contact you have an overlap, and you ask, well, what is the one that's just about to break? I'm going to call that R minus. It's the first contact that's going to break. Here we go back to your comment. What my algorithm does is it puts these rattler particles, which have less than 3 contacts. This one has 1 or 0 contacts, depending on how accurate my algorithm is. Just puts it at the edge, because there's no force when it's out of contact. So the problem is, where should those particles be? And it'll depend on what your physical system is. So for right now, we're just putting them at the edge, but we have to study, we have to sort of maybe average over all possible positions or do something. We have to think carefully about the rattlers. This actually caused a very interesting debate in the literature between Torquato et al., Donev and Torquato, and Liu, Nagel, and Silbert. Torquato said, Torquato got one result. It was how G of R decays from the peak. And he got one exponent. I'll show you in a second. And then Liu, Nagel, Silbert did it. So Torquato did it without rattlers. Liu, Nagel, Silbert did it with rattlers, and they got different answers. And they thought about it for a little while. It's kind of funny. So here's the answer for with rattlers at very small compressions. And so I show R plus and R minus as a function of system size. And here I'm just going to show you what the data shows, and then I'm going to try to argue that it's a simple result. So here you see that R minus scales as 1 over the number of particles. So the contact that's just about to break goes to 0 in the large system limit. The contact that's just about to break goes to that value goes to 0 in the large system limit. The contact that's just about to form also goes to 0 with a different power law.
Sorry, but that R is the amplitude of the division, or what is R plus minus?
You order the R's. You have the positive ones, and you have the negative ones, and you. So this is R plus, and this is R minus.
But just as in a given configuration, there's nothing to do with the mode amplitude.
That's right. This is all geometry, and so I'm averaging over everything. So this is now a large-scale simulation, averaging over hundreds and hundreds of configurations and studying different system sizes.
What percentage are actually?
They're typically around 5% or less, but it's not a there's not a system size effect, so they stay 5% even in large systems. And here I show you without rattlers, there's a robust 1 over n scaling. You would expect this to be true because R minus has nothing to do with rattlers, right? It's just contacts. Whereas this depends on rattlers or not. And so this is a manifestation of this fight that people are having. You don't know where to put the rattlers. Okay, so the result that I just showed is actually can be obtained from careful studies of G of R. So careful studies of G of R show this sort of empirical relation for this is the contact side when particles are overlapped. It's sort of some convolution of an exponential and a Gaussian. It's much narrower width than the other side where the contacts haven't formed. If you just pull numbers randomly from this distribution and look at the smallest one, it scales as 1 over n. So you can just get the answer that I just showed from G of R. So it's just looking at the rare events in this distribution. Same for this. If you just look for pull numbers randomly from this distribution, you get these power laws that are at least greater than 1, somewhere between 2 and 3.
Is eta supposed to be sort of universal in some sense?
This I don't know. You get a variance depending on whether you put in rattlers or not. So I'm not quite sure. What I plan to do is to weakly thermalize. And so this is just a conjecture. If you weakly thermalize, do you just get back to this? I mean, what causes the difference between this and this? The cause in this case is because of the potential. One is there's a force between them, and the other there isn't. And so that's causing a big disparity here. If you thermalize and sort of get the right potential, it's possible that these are similar. I would say this is pretty robust, but not well explained. This may be dependent on all sorts of things.
I'm confused about this controversy with the rattlers. I mean, you think that there's an obvious prescription, which is given that there's no energy cost for moving a rattler, you just put temperature epsilon, where epsilon is so small that you don't break any contacts. So nothing happens to those.
But that hasn't been done. That's what I'm doing here. Okay. Hasn't been done.
So basically the rattlers of zero probability of touching.
Yeah, the problem with the experiment you're saying is you get into all these problems. When you add epsilon to temperature, contacts break. Contacts form. So what's you said?
You'd have to do, well, I guess you'd have to go through your deltas. Work out where the smallest delta is and put it on an amplitude which is smaller than.
That's what I'm doing.
Okay. Good.
One thing that I think would be very interesting, but maybe a negative result, would be I've I've explicitly said systems in the large system limit are anharmonic, or at least that's what I've sort of led you along, because I said a contact's going to break at R goes to 0. In the large system limit. I've led you on that path. It's possible that that's not quite true, because you may need a finite fraction of contacts to break to get to be anharmonic. I haven't talked to you a lot about that. So one thing I'm very interested in also is, how does it depend on delta phi? So you expect, one thing you might expect, which we show here, is that R minus is sort of proportional to delta phi. That delta phi is the amount of compression, so you basically take contacts away from breaking by adding in compression. And so I've shown that here. So I show R minus over delta phi versus delta phi, and there's a pretty flat region here that says that R minus scales with delta phi. But there still is this overall system size dependence, which sort of saves the day and sort of makes it still an interesting problem. And so what we need to do now is ask what R is required for two contacts to break, what R is required for three contacts to break, what R is required for three contacts to break, and see if there's interesting system size dependence.
Corey, so I'm trying to think about this. You have non-attractive potentials,
yes,
but you're applying a delta field. Is that fundamentally different from a system where you have an attractive potential and where you can vary the attractive potential? I mean, can we think just at the zeroth level of some relationship between this delta phi on one hand or an attractive potential on the other hand?
So if you take an attractive potential and compress it to packing fractions or densities that I'm talking about, then you do see some of the same results. But with an attractive potential, you can stabilize much lower packings because they'll stick to each other.
Right.
So the answer is sort of good news and bad news, that if you go to densities that I'm talking about, then yes. But then the attractions aren't necessary because you already have the overcompression.
But I'm thinking in terms of the picture that Takeshi shows, where he has happy spheres and unhappy spheres.
In the harmonic potential, there's no discontinuity of secondary here. That is important here, that the secondary is making a major role. But I see the second becomes very interesting, because intuitively you think that alpha will decrease with delta T, right?
So put a caveat here. I haven't averaged over rattler placement.
I see.
So this could be an argument.
Less likely to have rattlers at the higher density.
Yeah.
So I would expect this to go down.
So I need to.
No, this may be interesting. Because this may be making a transition from this system to this more harmonic system, because this very similar thing happens in the harmonic system, not because of this second derivative discontinuity, but because of the transition from the first neighbor to the second neighbor.
We'll
talk about that. I think that it's very similar. Does it have a sensitive
dimension also?
Yeah.
This is
a two-dimensional. Well, that is in the harmonic system. It's very sensitive because strain field diverges in two dimensions. But here it is not.
Two dimensions, yes, hexagonal packing. So if you shift things a little bit, you don't get another.
So that's what I'm saying. In two dimensions, in for harmonic system, it's very, very sensitive.
Can you say the two-dimensional comment?
Well, that's also a monodisperse case.
It's monodisperse.
Yeah.
Polydisperse is not
that. Yeah. So I definitely want to dispel. So please raise your hand that this has nothing to do with two dimensions. This is a bidispersed two-dimensional sample, and will behave exactly. Sorry, I'm overstating the point, but would behave very close to what a 3D monodisperse sample would do.
No, the comment was with respect to the second nearest neighbor.
Okay, yeah. Sorry.
So this is saying R plus goes up as you compress, which is your lot. So R plus is the smallest.
So the only difference between this and this so far, well, first, I divided by delta phi here. I didn't here. So the difference is what Takeshi is pointing out here, that this has a finite value. But that I need to be really careful about how I deal with the rattlers, because R plus is sensitive to the rattlers. It's saying, how far do I have to go before I hit a rattler? And if I put them in the middle, I'm going to get a different answer than if I put them right at the edge.
But wouldn't it make sense that R plus would go up? Because then you say you have a rattler, it's more likely to be about to form contacts if the system is more compressed. because the free volume is less.
Well, therefore,
unless that bus
goes down. Therefore, that I would expect the bus go down.
It's quite dependent on how you normalize it.
I do want to emphasize that it's not as simple as just thinking about the rattlers.
Yeah, okay.
There are two contributions. You see that there's a contribution that definitely a rattler can come into becoming the part of the force network, but also the force network, you can still be a part of the force network and then gain a contact. So there are two effects that are.
You could also look at the fraction of times that our plus or our minus is actually given by a rattler.
Exactly.
Right. So that give you some information.
So this one is well. This one is never, and this one is sometimes. So I have to decompose them. So then here's the issue that I was getting about this subtlety. Are R plus and R minus relevant at all? So R plus and R minus you can think of sort of in a Cartesian basis, x and y. But how am I adding the deformation? I'm moving along a particular mode. So you should really look at delta minus and delta plus, which are the values of delta if you move along that mode where you gain or lose a contact. And so one thing which would probably be bad is if delta minus was completely uncorrelated to R minus. Well, it's not. They're roughly linear, and R delta plus is linearly related to R plus. So there is a sense that this is sort of a robust feature. Okay, this is sort of the last topic and maybe the most controversial, so please think about this. So I guess I'll introduce it by talking about this nice work by Mathieu and Carolina that appeared in Neurophysics Letters a few years ago. So what they did is they had a hard sphere system, so a strictly hard sphere system, and they studied it near jamming. Jamming is where the pressure of this hard sphere system diverges, and they could look at different values, deviations from that point. So epsilon is how close you are to the pressure diverging. And so then they measured by using collisions, measuring momentum. Momentum changes, they measured an effective force. So they have all pair interactions, and from all pair interactions you can find out how far apart particles are. And then you can measure the force arising from that pair from momentum transfer. And so this is an effective force, it's a time average force, and then as a function of separation. And you find is a 1 over h behavior for this effective force. This effective force is exactly related or intimately related to the fact that you can get the pressure from the g of r at contact and the fact that you have a pressure divergence that goes as 1 over phi minus phi j, or where your pressure diverges. Those three things are related. And so it's a little vague, if you're interested, read their paper, but it's vague. I think what they did is they then used an analytic expression for the potential, the interaction potential between hard disks. It would be logarithmic in this separation. And from that logarithmic interaction, they calculated an affected density of states. But that's all they did, and they didn't comment on it. Notice that this shape, at least the way they plotted it, has no resemblance to the density of states that I showed before. If you can remember those, they had sort of a hump, and then they went flat. This has the wrong curvature, and so it's interesting.
What does it look like on the log scale for
omega? Yeah, it was on both. Let me quickly go back. This is the best way to go back, isn't it? So these are both linear.
Is it on the same side of the jamming point?
Yeah, that was what I was going to ask.
So it's on
is
the
this below.
This is on the other side.
Why? Yeah. So that's you do not expect to get the same.
Why?
Because here you have overlapping things.
But then there's a then but that's
then
exactly
there's a true singularity.
Then there's a true singularity at the point, and then you would never hope
but
to
it's
use.
It's asymmetric, right? Yeah. Why would you expect to, it's a truly asymmetric point? So why would you expect the same behavior above and below? I mean, you
let me say
that you have overlap and underlap, but in reality, it's a real different.
Let me say it a different way, okay? If you read the article, all the same words and verbiage and picture are the same, and then this is shown, and there's not a clear statement that says, we expect a very different d of omega for this.
Maybe the other way of saying it is if you created two packings exactly at yeah. YJ, like coming this way or that
yeah,
way,
what is
this is saying d of omega is very different. So.
And so I'm saying that this is a nice result, and we're showing that it's different, and I expect them to be different, but there was no expectation in the literature so far that they would be different, at least what I've read. Okay, so that sets the stage. This interesting result sets the stage for this. So I'm doing basically the same thing, except I have a more robust model. The model can be hard sphere and soft sphere, so particles can be separated and particles can overlap. And I'm just using the pair potential that I have. So I have some pair potential Fij dotted into the vector connecting centers. Peter's going to hate this. I normalize by the omega squared of the original static configuration and delta to get a dimensionless number. And then I plot as a function of underlap and overlap. So I'm just time averaging the interactions and seeing what I get.
These are your forces, not Matthew's.
Yeah, these are so the result would be what you would expect is you have to recover Matthew's result, right? I'm already sort of led you down that path that these are hard spheres banging around. You know, when they're out of contact, what's different? You know, how different is my model from hard spheres? I'm in the limit of small temperature, small deformation. How different is it? And so what you get is I'll show you in a second, you get Matthieu's result of 1 over separation. And then in the large overlap regime, you get what you'd expect, that it's a linear force law. So this would depend on the particular interaction that you choose. And then you get some smooth, which is nice, smooth crossover between hard spheres and soft spheres. So my claim would be this is the potential that you want to diagonalize.
Ooh. That is an us. They just stepped.
So
jump you both. Until then, I was agreeing.
Until then, now I don't. Okay, go.
Using the protocol you're using at zero temperature, okay, so I'm going back to this. In fact, just above the jamming point, there's no difference between the soft potential and the purely hard sphere potential. It's exactly the same. And it's only below, of course, that the hard sphere you cannot compress, the pressure is infinite, and your potential you can get in. Now, in the thermodynamic limit, wouldn't you expect then an exact change of behavior right at this jamming point? So it could be system size dependent in that case. When you're saying there's a crossover from one behavior to another, isn't it just the system size dependence? I would expect the change to be sharp.
The problem is I didn't have. So my expectation is that. So these are bigger. They're not 10,000 particles, but they're fairly big. And we'll of course do system size studies. But my expectation was that there would be some dynamic equilibrium, if you will, of particles in contact, particles. Coming in and out of contact, and particles, some dynamic equilibrium among all contacts.
So if I could say it a little bit differently, just maybe this is wrong, but the way I'm looking at it is that as you compress a system, there's not one particular volume where all of a sudden, for every contact everywhere, you go from non-contact to
exactly. Contact. That's I think if so you if you boil down my whole seminar, that
will already be established in some areas. In other areas, you may still have non-contact, and so that gives rise to this smooth transition, especially as you go to larger systems. Does that make sense?
What was the especially as you go to larger systems? I would say that at any system size, the particle contacts are not all.
Well, I'm just.
I think what you're talking about is your original thing of 5J distribution narrowed down. In system size, I think that's what the.
Yeah, so if you've got six particles, and it'll be a narrower range where you have this smooth behavior. For larger systems, that might be a wider range. That's just the way that I'm visualizing. Maybe that's not right.
These are
okay. Yeah.
Other way around.
No, yeah. So Takeshi says if you time average it, it may end up being the same. Yeah, that's correct. Okay.
So where is Corey? What? So this is your system.
Yeah.
This is your system at the just touching point.
Yeah, so what I do is it's similar in vein. I take a 240 now. It's really big. No, I'm just kidding. I take 240 particles, and it's a just touching system, and I add different amounts of delta, and then I let it fluctuate, and then I plot all the different deltas on this normalized in a certain way. So then I take a log, just to throw myself under a bus, I take a log plot, and I try to see these power laws emerging. So of course, I need more statistics, larger system sizes, so I can get the tails. But it is what it is. I mean, I want to get this much better, and I want to get this much better. Anyway, go ahead.
But Hartsfield potential below the closed packing volume fraction. If the system is thermalized, then the two-body velocity distributions have to be Gaussian. So it's just a reflection of the fact that you have a linear pair correlation function very close to the quantum. If you linearize the pair correlation function about the separation point.
You're saying that this is yeah. Sort of has a simple answer.
Yeah.
Yes. I think the thing that this minus one is not surprising, especially as you go this way, if they come more hard sphere-like. I think the issue that was being raised was, does this just go? Well, I'm not sure what the issue was. I mean, this sort of has to be one over the free space. And then it has to cross over to elastic. So I sort of think it can't be anything other than this. But I think there was some question about how it actually does it. Does it do it in a sharp way?
Would it be a sharp discontinuity if you went to the large element?
Yeah. And my first answer is...
Not a discontinuity, slope discontinuity.
My first guess would be no. But that's something I'm very interested in. But then I get back to my original claim is I think this is in this spirit of understanding what is the true effective potential between particles, what are the true equilibrium positions of the particles, that these modes are more relevant for understanding weakly vibrated, weakly deformed systems. And in that sense, it has a hard sphere part and a soft sphere part.
I mean, if you go back to, if you take that as a potential and do your eigenvalue analysis, are these eigenmodes of your system?
Yeah, so that's
a belief. I'm not
okay,
convinced.
So here's the to-do. So here's
the potential is the kinetic energy.
No, this is a reflection. This is a reflection of the inherent structures of the system.
That's fine.
So I mean, if you actually minimize with this potential, you know, you get back to your original position to the particles.
Now you want my beliefs? Okay, I'm a. my belief is.
Why don't you do this?
what did I say? I said this is a week old. I had to work my ass off to get this result.
Okay.
Why don't you do this? Okay, so I'll get to the to do this.
So what are you doing next week?
Stop exactly.
That's what. Stop surfing and going.
Yeah, exactly. I'm really interested in whether you can predict the anharmonicity from G of R, just from, you know, static snapshots of the system. Measure the effective potential, calculate the dynamical matrix, and determine to what extent there is a harmonic regime for this new effective potential. How are those modes different from the original modes? These are very interesting questions.
So I started out by asking about 2D versus 3D, and I can't see any reason why 3D would be any different from what. But I'm kind of curious. You showed some very nice pictures with a bidispersed. Don't you get the same result with monodispersed? I mean.
So when I study, so this is a very interesting question, and I'll poke fun at the audience again. So, whoops.
I'm glad it's a 3 foot point.
There's a current problem that I'm working on. Maybe some of you can get interested in it. I talked to Chandra a little bit. But if you study small systems of 2D monodisperse systems, you can actually get amorphous packings for small systems. But then, so then that would make you think, well, if I have these small amorphous systems, why can't I patch them together to form a large amorphous system? Turns out you can't do that. So what happens when you study these packings and 2D monodisperse systems is you get partially ordered systems. That, I think, is still a great mystery. I mean, there are these off-the-cuff or hand-wavy arguments that it has to do with local packing. But why can't you literally pack these small systems together and form large systems? So the idea is that in large 2D monodisperse systems, you would be studying partially crystalline systems. Where I expect you'll get somewhat different results. So we studied, so if it's like 20 particles or less, you get amorphous. Greater than 20, you get, how long?
We can get 100 protocol. Yeah.
I would love to talk to you about that, because I will swear up and down. So let me make my
claim. The first week of this program.
Yeah, I missed it. My claim, and this is a would be a great debate, I think, is that if they're truly mechanically stable, then no one has ever found. Maybe I haven't read this, but I like the other work was by Chiamara. Have you read this work by Chiamara, where he claims to also have find, but those aren't mechanically stable. And so let's talk about it as soon as possible. That it's, from my experience, it's very difficult to find amorphous.
So I have another question. This is going to be really provocative and probably show my ignorance more than anything else. But you're concluding that there's this sort of duality in the nature of the particles. There's a repulsive hard sphere nature, and there's an attractive soft sphere. And you're saying that that's the sort of potential that we should be using that acknowledges. That sounds to me exactly like an atomic potential. And so, I mean, when we think of real atomic systems with like real atoms like nickel stuff, I mean, sure, they're not hard, they're not repulsive potentials, but they are very, very steep, and they do have an attractive part. And so how is this fundamentally different than that, or is this just acknowledging?
The difference is entropy and energy. So the hard sphere is coming about from like an entropic. So this is an effective potential, and that's an energetic thing. So
I'm sorry again, Liz, but the fact that you have a potential that is cut off, is crucial for jamming. Right, so you otherwise you don't get soft mode if you don't have the exact soft mode. You don't get divergence of landscapes and stuff like this. So the fact that you have a one-sided potential is crucial for maybe not for what's going on at higher compression, but it's crucial for what's going on around the jamming.
That's right.
Point in the jamming phenomenology, the critical part of the jamming phenomenon.
And I'm saying that's actually, I think, maybe a red herring. What I think is relevant is that the particles, even though they have that cutoff potential, have to live in a dynamic equilibrium in almost any system.
If there was no concept of breaking contact, then it would not have
I agree.
I think Jill is correct that this discontinuity introduces the importance of topology. Okay, you're changing topology all the time during the vibration. And that's what I'm...
But if you compress it a little bit, you probably not do that.
Yes, if you compress enough, then it becomes the same as a soft spare. Mm-hmm. But this continuity, that's what I'm saying, that the simply diagonalizing the dynamic matrix may not be enough for liquid, not because the effective potential is wrong, but simply the diagonalization does not take this topological change into account. I think that's a crucial point. So I'm very much interested in your simulation of VM and D and see if that disagree. And for small, very, very small amplitude, it may agree, but I think, at a reasonable amplitude, I think this topological disorder would overdominate.
Well, the provocative result would be that in a large system, any amplitude would be wrong.
I don't know.
But I think then this kind of potential sort of enhances or the topological features.
Exactly. That's the whole point.
Specifically, what I'd like to know, for example, if you had, let's say, Leonard Jones, and you found an inherent structure, you do the Hessian, do the get modes, at what level of amplitude and harmonicity sets in under those conditions? Will it be much higher? Or?
So there isn't it about typically about one third of the melting point where anharmonic vibrations. It's not one third. Isn't it related to the melting point though? If you have a crystal.
Yeah, but that's a different kind of anharmonicity, right? It's not this topological anharmonicity. It's just
but it's anharmonic vibrations and coupling between different modes. No,
sure.
Says it's that important, right? It happens at 0.1 amplitude or something like that. It's a different.
So I was saying, my claim is that the topological, the anharmonicity is caused by topology. Mm-hmm. Set in much lower than anharmonicity is caused by the shape of the potential.
But it's from this contact breaking.
So
in granular systems, if people wanted to calculate dynamical matrix, there might be a problem.
So I just want to say one other thing. There's a big thrust to calculate dynamical matrices experimentally from following particle positions, so a covariance matrix or a displacement matrix. So this would cause problems for that too,
exactly.
Because there's a harmonic approximation in going from dynamical matrix to a cross correlation matrix. So.
Exactly.
Yeah. So there's a recent. I'm not annoyed at all. There was a really nice preprint recently by the Yode Penn group on colloidal, measuring a colloidal glass, and they look at the dynamical matrix obtained from a cross correlation, but there's no check that it's a harmonic.
One word about connecting your work and the metallic glasses. The inner world of the potential is like that, okay? And when this disappears, you have zero now, like that, very, very sharp, right? Now, in metallic glasses, potential is wide, and as a result, zero bar itself is very wide. And the same kind of, possible fluctuation is happening here, at the end of long tail zero bar, where that they go from first nearest neighbor to second nearest neighbor back again.
Yeah.
That's exactly the same. So I think there's a very strong connection between this fluctuation and that.
So you're saying it's all about where the things happening at the tail of the GFR?
All happening by the change of a topology. Yeah, tail of a GFR. Where that
it's where the potential contact, is sort of weak.
Yeah, how do you design the concept?
Know what to do.
Exactly. How do you define contact where the topology fluctuates? And that's a practical problem.
Okay.
So would you like to talk about this in terms of the coarse graining over what the coarse graining over the burden?
What do you mean by that?
Because what this effect of potential is, you're effectively coarse graining over contact breaking. And that's what the effective potential is.
Yeah, so I would want to say that there are effective contacts. So, yeah. So that potential represents sort of effective context.
And you could do that for any potential that's, a potential with a longer range cutoff. You'll still have particles coming in and out of range, and you could apply the same procedure to coarse grain over the.
Yeah, that's sort of.
Sort of looks similar to what classical density function would be. Again, instead of looking at instantaneous positions, it's really like time average density or something. Even for hard spheres, one could define some sort of free energy function.
Which is sort of what the Matthew thing does, right?
Yeah, except that magnitude, again, is at the jamming, near the jamming. The fact that you're isostatic is giving you the very simple relation, which is the potential, it's just a function of distance.
It doesn't depend on isostatic. If you're hyperstatic, you're still good then.
It's no.
I think it's very robust to.
We look forward to our next talk.